on this episode of Holy Ghost Notes. I'm a pocket guy.
I'll be prosecuted here pretty quickly for plagiarism.
You're still that same one velocity drummer, man.
Hey, what's going on? This is Matt Greiner and Timmy Anderson, and this is Holy Ghost Notes. How you doing, buddy?
I am awesome. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. You know, spring is coming, and the sun is out today, and hopefully when this is live and people are listening, the sun is still there, but it's nice today.
Yeah, it's beautiful. This whole week's been great. It's been months. I took my son out for a walk yesterday. We walked a couple miles, and it was probably like, you know, low 50s, but I mean, compared to what it's been, it felt like it was a beautiful day.
It's amazing what the sun does for everybody. I mean, I understand why people move to Florida. They say, I'm getting out of Pennsylvania and moving south. And as much as I do love winter and the snow, spring, just like the flowers come alive, just like your lawn starts to turn green, you sense that same, man, I just feel like I'm awake, you know, today. I feel like I want to be not only outside, but I want to be doing something. And so I always expect more traffic accidents in the spring. I always steer away, especially from any retail store, because as soon as the sun comes out, it's chaos. Especially here in Lititz. Lititz has been getting busy from our Rock Lititz complex, where currently we have Ariana Grande rehearsing, which is 3 miles from my house. And then you have new shopping centers in Lancaster, like the Belmont. And there's just a lot to do in this area.
Yeah. It's funny because 10 years ago, it was like just like this small, quaint little town. So I guess stuff is starting to pop up.
Yeah. Instead of starting brick by brick, 10 years ago, which was a nonprofit that Timmy and I did together, we should have just steered all of our attention into buying real estate and developing
That would have been smart, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we went the nonprofit route, and we're paying for it.
yeah, we are. it was fun though, while it lasted, right?
Yeah, you know, everything that you do is a learning experience, good or bad. And I'm glad that happened, because now we're doing this. So it's all working towards something. So today we're doing something kind of neat. We're sort of playing off of our podcast name, Holy Ghost Notes, and we're going to be talking about the drum topic, Ghost Notes and Accented Notes. And then the God topic today is going to be forgiveness.
Yeah.
So we have a good one lined up today. So thanks for joining us if you're listening to this. And we're very excited to be doing our second podcast, and we're happy you're along for the ride.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this has been fun, and we were really happy with how the first one went, so we figured, hey, why not? Let's keep doing it.
That's right. Yeah, so
ghost notes.
So ghost notes. This is, in the metal world, ghost notes are, if you're able to play ghost notes, then you are automatically on a different tier in the drum world. So in other words, there's the kind of drummer that I used to be, which is one velocity. And by velocity, I just mean when you hit an instrument, when you hit the snare, the toms, or the cymbals, you only have one volume, essentially. You know, there might be, you know, varying dBs. But in general, if you were to be playing in a library, it would all be too loud, okay? So I didn't have the desire necessarily, and certainly I didn't have the skill set to play with any. If you think of a if you think of a truck, most big trucks have a governor. I didn't have a governor, you know, something to slow me down or limit the volume of my plane. And this is certainly a skill set. It's not something that you just know how to do. Now, there are drummers who are more naturally gifted in this area, and they don't hit as hard in general, and so they're probably more likely to play with more ghost notes or just more variety in their velocity. So let's go back 16 years. I was starting the band, and for me as a drummer, and you might be listening to this and be in the same boat, I wasn't thinking about the velocity of my plane at all. It was not a thought. I was thinking about if you could picture a Pro Tools screen or any sort of recording software where you have these wave peaks, I was thinking about where those hits are. I was thinking about a grid and playing tight to a click track. I was thinking about executing all of my parts. And certainly now I understand that ghost notes are a part of that execution, but back then it was just a matter of playing to a grid, playing on time, keeping the beat, and frankly, getting through my parts, because I would always write something that I couldn't play and practice it until I could. And so it was hard enough for me just to keep track of my parts. There's no way I was going to focus on different velocities. And so fast forward a couple years, I was playing for church, and I wanted to play for a church in Lancaster called Victory. And Victory had a newer campus, and I went in, and they have this drum cage and this beautiful drum set, and I've been playing in the band for a little bit, and I'm starting to feel confident about my playing, and I know the songs. I've been practicing them. And I get up there, and I run through the rehearsal, or the tryout, I guess, as it was, and no one really says anything to me. I walk off stage, I go home, I get an email. Matt, thank you so much for joining us for tryouts. Unfortunately, your style does not seem conducive to what we are looking for. Thank you once again. Have a great day. And I'm like, what? My style, I played everything perfectly. And it didn't dawn on me at the time, but later on, you know, as I started touring with bands who were using more texture in their playing, it occurred to me that I was a one velocity player and that I needed to not so much focus less on playing parts well, but to take the parts I was playing well and to integrate different velocities or different volumes into my playing. So ghost notes really, in my mind, apply mostly to the snare, the snare drum, which is the backbone, the centerpiece, the epicenter of the drum set. Yep. If you're in a church service or you're at a concert and you're clapping your hands, you're clapping along to the snare drum, you know, typically speaking. And so ghost notes, if you were to say that and say name an instrument, you know, I would say drums. Okay, name a more specific instrument, say a snare drum. Because the snare drum is an instrument that has so many different textures and so many different applications to it. Mm-hmm. And so I can play on the 2 and 4 of a beat on the snare drum. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. And I could keep that beat going, okay, for the band, for the vocalist. But in between those hits, those strokes, you know, that backbeat, I could be applying little nuances that mostly go unnoticed to the crowd. And it's not going to necessarily change the sound of the song, but you might not notice the difference that it makes, but it adds a texture that creates what we call pocket. And it creates this groove. Mm-hmm. And so instead of just playing that 2 and 4, which is necessary in the song, or playing on the 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, you're all of a sudden hitting your snare drum at a much lighter velocity using what's called ghost notes on different parts of, say, a 16th note pattern.
Yeah. And that's a really good example of why Matt is a drum instructor. I was captivated, man. ghost notes are super cool. And I actually started playing drums in the church. So okay. accented notes, they were a must, you know? It was kind of like if you wanted to play this Hillsong song the right way, you needed to know how to accent your notes, you know? So I think for me, figuring out ghost notes really came to me actually focusing on stick control. Mm. Distance between my hits. So that stick is hitting probably, you know, I'm coming off the head of the snare like 4 inches, mm-hmm. Typically. And that's a full bodied hit. Mm-hmm. When I started to realize that I can't pull back those 4 inches to get back in time with a softer hit, I realized, okay, so I need to be at like an inch and a half. So that's how I started to really visualize ghost notes a little bit more. Just starting to think more about how far away I was pulling my stick before I would hit the snare. That really helped me hone in my ghost notes. But even the thing that's helped me more recently is just memorizing sticking patterns. Mm-hmm. And getting those down without accenting at all, just so I have it in my muscle memory. Even like the intro to the podcast is just, it's a sticking pattern that I committed to memory. It's right, left, left, right, right, left, left, right, left, right, right, left, left, right, right, left, left, right, left.
Wow.
If you didn't remember that, that's okay. but then I basically ghosted almost all the lefts. And then I threw some kick in there as well. But once I have that sticking pattern memorized, then I just, start to mess around with the velocity of my hits. Mm. And that's what it was for me. Granted, it's not something that you can just pick up the sticks and, play that groove and, maybe you can, maybe you're at that point, but, it took me a while. but yeah, it's like Matt said, it's such a cool way to add flavor, and add just another element, to your playing. And, as far as how to implement ghost notes, I think, that really goes into understanding subdivisions, which we can go into more in depth, I think, in another episode. But
yeah. So as far as the implementation, there's one thing that you said that I've actually heard before, and it makes me think of something that if you're listening to this, you can actually do right now, or after you're done listening to this. If you take a mirror and you put it up in front of your drum set, or sort of next to your drum set, so you could see yourself playing. Specifically your snare drum, and just actually watch how high your stick is coming off of the snare drum. So let's say the snare drum, which is obviously somewhat parallel to the floor, let's say that is the 90 degree angle. Well, let's actually do one better. Let's say that is pointing to 3 o'clock, okay? 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock. What you want to do is bring the stick the whole way up to 12, so it is at a 90 to the snare drum. It's directly up and down. That would be a pretty loud velocity. Now go, and next time bring it up to say 1 o'clock, and the next time 2 o'clock. And each time you come up, you're going to different, parts of that clock, different hour hands. And the higher the snare, the higher the tip of the stick is off of the snare. In other words, the more vertical it is, the louder velocity you'll have. And so it's a good way to practice and sort of build into your muscle memory this ability to pull your stick up pretty high and then don't pull it up so far the next time. The way that I practice ghost notes is by doing this. I typically practice with a mirror, not to be vain, but because oftentimes it's hard to tell what is wrong with your playing just by hearing it. Or if you're playing drums, you're not really using your eyes, you're using your ears, and you're sort of using this innate sense of rhythm. But there's a whole other element if you set up a mirror and you actually watch yourself playing, because you can correct things that you didn't even know were wrong. And so when I play with Amir and I rehearse through August Burns Red songs, oh, it would help me if my rack toms were flatter, because right now I can see that I'm bringing my elbows up because of the angle of the toms. Or, man, I feel like I'm sitting just a little bit too high. I'm sort of arching into the kit. If I sit a little bit lower, my legs will be parallel to the floor. Hmm. Same thing is true for implementing ghost notes. You're going to see how the velocity is tied into the height of the stick is tied into the velocity you're playing. So the way that I practice is I play with a mirror and I play simple backbeats, like I was saying, the snare on 2 and 4. And maybe I'm just playing eighth notes on my hi-hat, so 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, and snares on 2 and 4. So 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, and but instead of just counting eighth notes, which is what I'm playing with my hi-hat, I'm counting 16th notes. So I'm counting 1E and the 2E and the 3E and the 4E and the... Now you're starting to hear all of those opportunities for ghost notes. In other words, you could put a snare hit on every single one of those 16th notes and still accent the 2 and 4.
Yeah.
So you could play at low volumes on 1E and a, and then you could hit harder velocity on 2, then go back to quiet for 2E and 3 and then hard again on 4. So it starts to sound like, and you're building that control to be able to do that. Well, obviously, not every song is going to warrant that many strokes. So then you just start to take some out. So say, okay, I'm just going to accent on the 1E. So 1E and a 2E and a 3E and a 4E and a 1E and a 2. Then switch it over one to E end. So instead of 1E, just move 1 over to E end. So 1E and 2, 4, 1E and 2. And move it over one more to end a. So 1E and a, 2E and a, 3E and a, 4. Then move it over one more. There's 4 total. 1E, E end a, and a 1. Or a 2. And you're just picking two parts of that 16th note pattern to hit your snare drum. That's all you're doing. You're just hitting your snare drum, but you're hitting it at a lighter velocity. And you'd be amazed how hard this is. Depending on what your kick drum's doing, depending on where your snare drum, harder hits are, where the loud velocities are. But try that. Do 1E, E end, and a, and 2. I'm sorry, a 2. 1E, E end, and a 2. And I started doing this a couple years ago, and it's neat how, for me, typically speaking, the stuff I practice doesn't show up in my playing for like 3 months, 4 months. And that's really frustrating, because there's a time of like, okay, I've put in all this work, I've been practicing these ghost notes, I've been practicing hitting at lighter velocities. And when I show up to play for church or I'm playing with my band, it's like nowhere to be found. It's like I'd never even practice it. But then one day, for me at least, you're playing or I'm rehearsing, and all of a sudden I look down and there it is. It's showing up just like I've always been able to play it. So if you're working on ghost notes, keep working at it, even if you don't see the payoff. If you've never worked on them, start really simple. Start by pulling that mirror into your practice space. And like Timmy was saying, start to use that stick control where you're, okay, I'm realizing the fact that I'm bringing the stick really high. I'm going to try to bring it a little bit lower on some other hits and start to hear the difference.
Yeah. And there's actually a really cool device that I just learned about this past week, actually. And it was released at the NAMM show, the expo in California. And it's this thing called Tone Alley. And it's super cool. It looks like the top half of a wooden chair. So it has like the dowels, and there's basically this open space right in the middle, and then there's 3 dowels on one side and 3 dowels on the other, and then you obviously have like the base of the chair where you would sit You could actually sit it on top of a snare drum if you wanted, or you could put a practice pad on it, or you know, whatever you want to do. And basically what it forces you to do is control where your sticks are. So depending on which rung you're between, you know, you have to change how you're holding your arms, and obviously the goal is not to hit the wooden dowels at all.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's super cool. I don't have one, and I haven't used it, but the concept made so much sense to me when I saw it, and I was like, man, this could completely...
Yeah.
I mean, I would probably get it, and I get so frustrated with myself because as far as that goes, my stick control, it's all over the place. You look at my snare drum, and I mean, there's... a 4-inch circle where you can tell I've been beating that head away, you know, but it's, yeah, I mean, sometimes all it is it's a mental game, and it's just taking note of where your sticks are, you know, how high you're raising them up or, you know, pulling it back. And that can sometimes make the entire difference on how easy some groove is to play.
Oh yeah,
as opposed to another. It's crazy.
I've actually done that before, and I've thought about doing it again. I'm working on double bass for this Constellations tour we're doing this summer, and because there's some pretty quick parts, and I've built some bad habits with double bass playing. You know, when you're playing at like 170, 180 BPM, you know, oftentimes you can sort of build up. Kind of, I guess you'd say, lazy habits, and so sometimes the angle of my foot or my leg is not in line with the pedal. And I was thinking, man, it'd be nice to train for this tour if I had something that would keep my leg and keep my ankle in line with the pedal, so that I didn't have an option of, you know, moving it one direction or another, which has just become sort of a habit and not a good one. And it sounds like the same thing's true of this mechanism. It's you know, some people will like go as far as to put sandbags or like ankle weights on their legs when they practice double bass. There are things you can do to teach your body how to perform at a higher level. I'm always interested in that stuff because it really does work. It's drumming is more like, you know, an athlete playing football than it is like playing the violin. I think there's a lot of mechanics. That are involved in drumming, and I would consider myself a drummer, but I wouldn't really consider myself a musician, because the only part of me that aligns with being a musician is the fact that I hit things. I hit instruments. I hit circular objects, you know, with sticks, with pieces of wood, which makes sense if you know me, because I'm very mechanically minded, and I like to work, and I like to sweat, and I like to, you know, see the fruit of my labor. I like to hear it. I like to it just kind of aligns with, yeah, who I am. So it's interesting. With drumming, you can do stuff like this. You can use certain, you know, boundaries or certain inventions, if you will, as silly as they might seem at times, to help you advance your playing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were mentioning that you're more mechanical. You've got such an understanding of tone. And we, even in episode one, we were talking about how we used to use those plastic rings. I still use them at times, but the plastic rings just to, you know, as a shortcut, so you don't have to tune your drums.
Yeah.
The fact that you understand tone and know what tones you like and know how to get those tones. I mean, that's musicianship right there, man.
Yeah, well, yeah, but what you didn't know is I was on a forum while we were doing that podcast, and I was just reading it right off the forum. So that's what.
So that forum was basically your plastic ring.
Yeah, yeah. The forum was, yeah, the forum. Well, I'm actually doing that right now too. So yeah,
that's funny. Man, I need to learn from you. My stuff probably sounds like nonsense. I'm just spouting stuff out of memory. But
I'll send you the link after the podcast. Yeah, we don't want anyone to know where we're getting our information from.
Yeah, there you go.
And then on the secret. God topic, it's kind of the same thing. I just go on Tim Keller's website and I just read what he's written already. So
perfect. So we run a podcast that's actually an official forum podcast and a Tim Keller podcast all merged into one.
I'll be prosecuted here pretty quickly for plagiarism. Yeah. But it was nice knowing you, Timmy. Thanks for having me on your show.
But to close out the ghost notes topic, I just want to say one more thing. Growing up, I mean, I've been playing drums as long as I can remember, but I was always a fill guy. I always loved throwing these random fills in, and that was the funnest thing to play. And since I've introduced accented notes and ghost notes and, like, complex sticking patterns, like, I'm no longer a fill guy.
Mm.
Like, I love just sitting in that backbeat and throwing in these weird, cool things. Like, I could play through a whole song with barely any fills.
So what kind of guy are you now? You used to be a fill guy. Would you consider yourself a groove guy?
I'm a pocket guy.
Can you explain what pocket guy means for someone who's literally thinking of their jean pocket right now?
Yeah, sure. So pocket is, I think, and I've heard so many different explanations and definitions for what a pocket is, but in my opinion, it's when you can kind of sit back and be sensitive to the needs of the song or to the needs of whatever's going on, and just kind of groove, you know, sit like you're just playing this groove and you're throwing in these little like accents and flares and things that it's not over the top, it's not crazy, it could still be really, really difficult to play. But it doesn't come across as this like crazy fill that you didn't just solo for an hour, like you know, you played in that pocket, you attached yourself to this groove and just kind of went with it.
That's pretty good. Which forum did you just read that off of?
There's no forum here, man.
So I just thought of something while you're saying that. It seems to me that maybe pocket is proof of the fact that you aren't just listening to yourself playing, but you're listening to everything else. But not just that, it's proof that you have put time into thinking about the part instead of just playing the first thing that came to mind. And a good point of that is a song we wrote called Whitewash years ago. It's on Constellations. There's a part in the first, I don't know, minute of that song where I'm playing the mini china with my right hand and snare hits with my left hand, and it's the basic premise of the part is the sticking is right, left, left. So do that right now. So right, left, left, right, left, left, right, left, left, right, left, left. Your right hand's hitting the lateral velocity on the cymbal, and your left hand's hitting the snare playing ghost notes. So imagine that you're playing that without ghost notes, and all the velocities are the same volume. So you have da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Now take that same idea, same sticking. Nothing else has changed except for the fact that it's a lighter velocity on your snare. Now you have... There's a little bit more density and texture to it, and now all of a sudden, the drums aren't really the primary focus of that part. It's the guitar. The overall song just sounds better. And so that's probably not what I played initially. I had the sticking down, but as I started to play it more often and practice it and started to hear what it could be, I altered the way I played so that it had ghost notes and therefore, I think, more pocket. And so if you don't understand what pocket is, then maybe start by thinking about the song instead of your drumming, you know, as you're playing. Think about what other people are playing. And then second of all, or on the other hand, if you do know what pocket is and you're trying to get better at it, take what you're already playing and just think of different ways to add depth to it. So it's not just a linear sound. There's more going on than just one volume and Therefore, in the end, the song sounds more musical. So that part in Whitewashed, I bring up because I learned how to play Ghost Notes, and I started using it there, and I haven't really used it ever since.
You're telling me there's no other ABR song with Ghost Notes in it since Whitewashed?
it's been 10 years since I started using those Ghost Notes. Boy,
you're still that same one velocity drummer, man. Yeah.
As you can tell, I've really been working hard at my drumming, and I'm very much so improving. That's funny.
That is a good example, though. I love that groove. It's super cool.
You know that groove?
I do.
Oh,
I do.
Wow. I feel honored.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I listen to your music occasionally.
You do?
Yeah.
What does your wife say about it when you have it on?
Dude, my wife and I, our relationship was built in the emo days. So
Ooh. We
weren't necessarily into heavy metal per se, but I mean, it was all screamo. It was all heavy, you know, heavy stuff.
Would you consider August Burns Red? Would you consider any single August Burns Red song an emo song?
No.
So what exempts August Burns Red from, or what excludes us from being emo?
Part of its lyrical content. You also don't have like an out of key singer, you know. you guys have like this pumping, driving, you know. I mean, so it's really hard to define your style of music because even though it technically falls under like the metal umbrella, you can't just pull up another band that's under that same umbrella and expect to hear the same thing, you know. You guys have a sound that's very much your own at this point.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. But it's funny. Okay, well,
cool.
Enough about drums. We all know we need to get better, and now we know a little bit more about how to get better. So let's switch gears here and take a look at the God topic, forgiveness.
Forgiveness. Yeah, I mean, our conversation that we had when we decided to start this podcast in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, Matt and I talked for a good 20 minutes on this topic. So, fitting that we're hitting it early on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, and this is so important. And this is something that, I don't know. It's forgiveness. I think it really has to be at the heart of Christianity because it's there would have been no way if you believe in God and you believe that Jesus actually came and he died on the cross, that there would have been no way for him to be there on the cross unless he had a sense of forgiveness, one that we'll probably never realize the extent of. Because why would he lay down his life so that you and I and everyone that's listening to this can live and have freedom and have a future, unless he saw that forgiveness was an option, forgiveness was a reality, and forgiveness was the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I look at my life, someone has done something that has hurt me, intentionally or not, and therefore the reaction in you is to either respond with all sorts of different emotions or to respond with forgiveness. And I'm the kind of person that looks at the people around me and I say, well, that person's doing this with their life. I'm curious to see how that turns out for them. They're making decisions and choices I wouldn't make. I wonder how it will work out. And if you look enough at the people around you, you'll start to see a trend, I think, that people that are quick to forgive and quick to extend grace to those around them are people that you want to be around, because mm-hmm. they are aware of the fact that everyone makes mistakes and everyone is in a position where they could offend or hurt the people around them. And certainly if they're extending forgiveness to other people at liberty and freely and almost immediately, then you realize that that person has a pretty good grasp on their own sin and has a pretty good idea of the fact that they are not perfect and they need to be extended forgiveness as well. So mm-hmm. let me take a look at this on a more personal level. I was listening to some, I don't know if it was a podcast, but I was talking to someone, or I was listening to someone talk about marriage, unhappy marriages, okay, which unfortunately are very, very common. So this person was saying that there was a study done on unhappy marriages. And there was a group of people that were polled on how they respond or how they treat their spouse in an unhappy marriage. And in direct correlation to how they treated their spouse, there was a result, or there was a something changed for the good or the bad. So there was a large group of people who, of course, responded to their spouse, who they didn't like all that much. They were very unhappy in their marriage. And they responded with bitterness, resentment, even contentment. I was listening to Ben Shapiro yesterday, who's someone I really like to listen to on podcasts, and he was talking about the difference between anger and contentment. And he actually said anger is a good emotion. It's actually a healthy emotion. Contentment is where you start to go over the cliff. And so so imagine being upset with somebody, but then take it 10 miles further and even 20 miles further than that, and you have maybe contentment, which says, I really cannot stand you. And I have this deep, deep hatred for who you are. And so in a marriage, if you're being treated without love and respect, if you're being treated like you're not needed or not understood, then your natural response to that is certainly not forgiveness, and it's certainly not love. And so a large percentage, I think it was around 80% of people, responded to their spouse in a courting fashion. In other words, with angst, with contentment. And so what was the result of that? Well, of course, the marriage suffered. It just went down and down, because what happened? The spouse was treated with that contentment. And what does that do? Well, all of a sudden they're saying, well, you did that to me. How dare you do that to me? How dare you say that to me? Look at what I've done for you. And they respond the same way. And certainly no one's breaking the cycle. But what I found incredible about this, and you sort of know where I'm going already, is that there were a small percentage of people who responded to their unloving, disrespectful spouse with love. And not only love, but forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can imagine that the marriages in those cases got better. But what surprised me is that oftentimes the spouse who is on the receiving end of that forgiveness is not the one who, when polled, said, my marriage is really good and I'm happy. The person extending the forgiveness was polled. The person laying down their own desire to lash out and fight back, that person, the person extending forgiveness, said, yeah, I'm actually happier than I've ever been. And my marriage actually really isn't all that bad. Now, wait a second. How does that make any sense? Shouldn't the person on the receiving end of that love and forgiveness be the one saying, man, I'm pretty happy. Their cup's getting filled up, if you will. Their marriage is improving if you look at their spouse. I mean, who cares what I'm doing? Who cares how I'm responding? Look at what I'm getting from this person. But the person on the receiving end was saying, I'm really not all that happy. Mm-hmm. The person extending that love and forgiveness, they were saying, I am actually pretty happy. And my marriage is pretty good, and I have a lot of hope for this. And that just struck me, because if that's true, and I believe it is, because there's something miraculous about forgiveness, then we need to take a serious look at that, and we need to start applying that, not in in just our marriages, but in our relationships and our friendships, and according to the Bible, in the way that we treat our enemies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head, man. I mean, everything I had to say about it. I mean, it's so true, though. I mean, most people, I think, and in my experience, most people see forgiveness as something that benefits the other party. But really what it is it benefits you. The forgiver is the one who's benefiting because, you know, when you have bitterness, it's not a good feeling. And it's not necessarily for the other person. The other person might not even know that you have some kind of resentment or bitterness towards them. Mm-hmm. You're the only one that's feeling that. You're the only one that's suffering through that bitterness. And so when forgiveness comes into the picture, I mean, it's benefiting you. The other person doesn't even have to be apologetic. You know, if you're holding something against somebody and you forgive them for it, that's freedom that you're taking. You know, you're releasing something that's toxic. And
is a good way to put it.
You're releasing it, and so you're free of that, and you benefit from being free of that, regardless of how the other person feels or responds or whether they even know what happened or what they did. You know, it's forgiveness is a heart thing that really comes down to you and you alone. And I can say from personal experience that's 100% the way to go every time. You know, that it's those times where I feel like I can't forgive somebody that are really just the hardest on me. If I go a day or a couple days or even a week or something, holding on to that bitterness and that angst, you know, it makes me sick, you know, physically sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's physiologically, you look at the chemical makeup of our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
It actually responds to those emotional reactions in a physiological way. And I don't have the research. I don't have a forum in front of me right now. But there is research.
That's all right. I do. What are you looking for? I can search for anything.
I mean, there is research that supports the fact that when you're harboring bitterness, and I'm being careful not to say anger because you're exactly right. Anger is a healthy thing. You look in the Bible and it talks about righteous anger, you know. God gets angry, therefore it's not sin. There's research that supports you harbor that bitterness, and it's like, you know, these toxic chemicals are created that actually break down your body. You know, it's like, it's wild. I love when the spiritual and the physical kind of merge on that side.
They're very connected, and it seems to be pretty obvious too when you look at your own life. You know, that the times that you're thriving spiritually are oftentimes the best time of your, you know, the best times of your life. Not just spiritually, but it affects everything that you do. I remember, and I don't know if we talked about this already, but you know, if your house is in order and your family is intact and your relationships are great at home, then you can walk out of the house, you can step out that door, and the second you walk out the door, you know, your neighbor, you know, might start screaming at you, you might get in a car accident on the way to work, you might get fired on the way home. I mean, there can be all these terrible things that happen, and your day was terrible, but your life is still intact. But on the mm-hmm. on the contrary, if your life at home, if your relationships are, you know, stressed and split at the seams, then you leave home and you get a promotion and you have the best work day you've had all year, and you know, there's all these sort of extracurricular things happening to you. It's a good day, but it doesn't inflate you to the sky because your life at home is not intact. And think about that relationally. If there's people in your life that you haven't forgiven and are not, you're not extending that grace towards them, and you're harboring bitterness and resentment, then it doesn't really matter how great your life is, financially, or materially, or in any other aspect, because there's this one thing that happens to be at the root of every other, you know, success you've had. It sort of drags everything else down. And it makes me think of something. And what do you think about this? So we're talking about forgiving other people, right? How do you forgive other people, and what effects does it have on you and the other people around you? Yes, you know, forgiveness can be hard for me in regards to forgiving other people, but what about when it comes to forgiving yourself?
Interesting. I wish you had warned me about this question. that's a really good question. I mean, my immediate response would be that forgiveness is always a good thing, regardless of who it involves. So forgiving yourself, you know, from experience, it's actually more of a process, and it's a lot harder for me to do.
Correct.
Than to forgive other people.
I feel the same way.
But it's absolutely something you should do, you know? And I think, too, and you know, I don't want to, like, bash any Christians or anything, but I think that there was this gray area between pride and self-esteem or self-worth, where the, you know, a lot of Christians were talking about humbleness in a way that was actually detrimental to your self-worth,
mm-hmm.
where you actually have to belittle yourself,
mm-hmm.
To be in this quote-unquote holy state, you know? And I think that, you know, at least for me, that really negatively affected how I viewed myself and viewed life. I've since overcome a lot of those false views.
Mm-hmm.
But I think forgiving myself was part of that too, or realizing that the things that I was holding against myself, I didn't even need forgiveness for.
Mm.
You know, I was, you know, and I am by no means a perfect human being. No one is. I've done so many things that that I could rightly hold against myself.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at what Jesus did, you know, what was done on the cross for us, you know, that sin was abolished. You know, that need for us to do animal sacrifices or whatever,
mm-hmm.
what have you,
yeah.
to be right with God again, you know, that was removed. So again, I mean, from that forgiveness standpoint, you know, whatever we're not forgiving ourselves for is literally just, we're just not doing it. We don't have to do anything physically to get right with ourselves. We just have to forgive ourselves.
Yeah, that's true. And what you said reminds me of, have you heard of that quote, don't think less of yourself, think of yourself less often. And that makes me, that sort of parallels what you said about Christianity, where I was indoctrinated with the idea of, you know, always be humble and exercise humility.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, you carry more of those things with you than you think you do from your childhood and from the way you were raised. And I really do struggle with this idea of forgiving myself. If someone hurts me or someone offends me, it's not all that hard for me to say, well, that's fine, you know, no problem, and just get over it. But if I do something that's offensive or do something that hurts other people, I have a very hard time forgiving myself. And there was a story I heard years ago about a lady who was meeting with a pastor over and over again saying, I just can't forgive myself. I just can't forgive myself, you know, for what I've done. And the pastor over and over again, he just kept reminding her, you know, you can't hold this against yourself forever, you know, and she said, I know, but I just can't forgive myself. And he said, well, has the other person forgiven you? And she said, yes. I mean, in the very beginning, there was no hesitation on his part. And he said,
yeah.
And he said, so he's forgiven you. She said, yeah. And he said, but you're having a hard time forgiving yourself. And she said, yes. And he said, okay. And a light bulb went off and he said, all right, let me explain it to you this way. He said, the more that you understand how sinful you are, and the more you understand how undeserving you are of forgiveness, the more in love with the gospel and with Jesus and with his sacrifice you'll be. And the more in love with him that you become, the quicker you'll be on the path to forgiving yourself. So you have to start with the pretense of, I am actually worse than I think I am. I'm actually a much worse person than I want to believe. Certainly this thing I did is wrong and it's a bad thing, but it doesn't even scratch the surface of just how sinful you are. And so what does that do? Well, it can create in you a response to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe that a God would want to love me. Mm-hmm. And if he truly does love me, and he loves me like that, and yet he sees my sin and he sees what I'm capable of, then I'll follow him forever. And you fall more and more in love with Christ, and in return, you get freedom from not only your sin, but from the guilt and the shame that's associated with it. And, you know, of course that's helpful in my head, but when you face, you know, when something bad happens in my life, I, 9 times out of 10, and maybe even more than that, I fault myself. I have massive disappointment in myself. That's my response to it. It's rarely, you know, bitterness and resentment towards the other person. It's rarely, you know, withholding forgiveness. Typically speaking, I have a very hard time saying, you know what, I forgive myself for this, and I'm going to move on. And so if you're listening to this and you're struggling with the same thing, I'm with you. I mean, I understand the reality of the gospel and Jesus' forgiveness for us. But I'm certainly not negating the fact that, you know, if you're having a difficult time with accepting that forgiveness and that grace, then you're certainly not alone in that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's well, I mean, one thing I guess I want to also not to bring doom and gloom in, but there are consequences to our actions. So, I mean, the beauty of the gospel is obviously that Jesus died and took away the need for us to take that not to be responsible, but to have to deal with those things, you know, to deal with, like, our sin was abolished. But there are still consequences, you know. For instance, I could forgive myself or come to a place where I've forgiven myself for something, but that thing that I did might have, you know, constant reminders.
That's true.
What I did, you know. And that's just kind of the reality of life, unfortunately. And I think this kind of goes outside of forgiveness and more into, you know, how we deal with those things moving forward, you know, because you can forgive yourself and still be faced with the mistakes that you've made.
Correct.
The triggers. Right. Yep. But again, I mean, that is the beauty of the gospel, is that, you know, I mean, our instinctive nature makes us feel like we have to earn things. You know, we have to do something in order to deserve whatever's being given to us. And I mean, the beauty of what Jesus did is we don't, you know, it's not us at all. You know, we're lower than dirt. We are.
Yes.
You know, there's nothing we can do to deserve that. That forgiveness and that grace, and the fact that all we have to do is accept that grace
That's and forgiveness. That's challenging.
It's challenging. It is a beautiful thing, regardless of how challenging it is.
Tim Keller, he actually, what you just said kind of reminds me of this. He very famously says, I have to think of what he says. It's not going to be word for word, but I'm not exactly sure what he says, but basically the summary.
Just pull up his website real quick and read the quote.
Yeah.
You're never going to live that one down, man.
Yeah, I know. I'm on the forum right now. He says something like, the gospel says this. The gospel stands for this. At the base of everything, we're more flawed and sinful and dark than we want to believe we are. And yet, at the same time, we're more loved and accepted than we can even imagine. And so think about that. You know, we certainly are more sinful and more flawed and more dark than we would want to believe we are. But at the same time, we're more loved and accepted in Jesus and his sacrifice than we would ever, you know, hope that we could, that we could be. And so if you let that sink in, you let that settle in, then it's a strange paradox in a sense, because you're worse than you thought, and yet at the same time you're more loved and accepted than you could imagine. And I think that's probably the answer to forgiving yourself and subsequently forgiving other people.
Yeah, for sure. I have one other wrench I want to throw in, play a little bit of devil's advocate here. And I don't know the answer to this, so I apologize for throwing this at you. But we've covered forgiveness to some extent. What about forgetting? Forgiving and forgetting. You always hear that phrase, forgive and forget. How do you think forgetting comes into play after you've forgiven?
Yeah, for just thinking about the last couple years of my life, it's important for me. It's very important to remember the lessons that I learned. In other words, there's decisions I made that weren't great at times, and to learn from those things and to certainly not forget. But then there's this element of moving on. And I think that's what I'm currently learning. I've been learning a lot about moving on. And for me, I'm a very sentimental person. So events and places and things and music and it just, you know, certain things are triggers for me that take me back to a place that is kind of painful to visit, but it's unintentional on one hand. On the other, it's painful. And so how do you, in a sense, forget about things that really shouldn't be affecting you or don't have to affect you for the rest of your life? And I think that's something we have to do, because if you believe what the Bible says about your old sinful nature or about your past, you know, your past doesn't dictate you. You don't have to identify with your failures. I think you need to remember them and learn from them, but moving on and saying, okay, it's a new day and I have a lot of life to live and I still have purpose here, is very important. Otherwise, I think you would eventually fall into this woe is me, I'm nothing, I'm worthless, I have no purpose. And what is that rooted in? It's essentially rooted in a lie that your past failures, your past mistakes, things that were said about you, things that were done to you, are true. And I don't believe that. And so it was told to me very recently that when you are triggered to, when there's something that happens, you see something, hear something that reminds you of a painful thing in your past, to instead of use the energy and time to dwell on those things, to just automatically stop, change gears and to pray and to talk to God. And I am not very good at that yet. That is definitely not natural to me. But how could that yield anything other than a fruitful result? Because if God truly does love you, and yet at the same time understands you and therefore knows about everything, you know, more than you do about your past and your future, then you're talking to the person who can tell you exactly who you are. And if you can let that blanket all the failures and all of the hurt from your past, then I think you'll start to change the way that you see yourself and forget about the things that you just shouldn't be thinking about anymore.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I think, I think you can't forget things that have happened because they kind of make you who you are. You know, you go through things and you learn from your mistakes, hopefully. I think, and I'm just going to come at it more from a relational or a relationship standpoint, in that if I've forgiven someone for something they've done, you know, should I forget about that thing? and there's that whole concept of, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And, you know, I actually at this point in time can't really speak to whether I've adopted that philosophy or not, because I can't say that I've been hurt too many times. But I definitely, you know, it's a constant struggle to know, like, if this happened, should I be guarded around this person next time around, you know, or do I completely forget about what's happened here and just, you know, forgive them and move on like we're starting fresh, you know, and and maybe this is something that I need to read a little bit more. I can't say that I've ever really studied that principle too much in the Bible, but maybe I'm so if I'm listening back to this podcast later, I'm challenging myself right now to figure out what I feel about that.
Yeah, pretty much. If you're listening to this, just know that this podcast is it's actually just for us, and we might actually just make it private eventually so that Timmy and I can just sort of talk for a while and then listen to our own podcast, A Party of Two, and
we'll come back a year from now and see if anything's changed, if you feel differently.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's good stuff. That is, that's what it's all about.
For sure.
So I hope you've enjoyed this this segment. I hope that your ghost notes are more subtle and more nuanced than ever. And on the God topic of forgiveness, I hope that this has spoken to you and given you some new insight.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, guys, for listening and for tracking with us so far. And I'm excited for the next episode.
What are we talking about on the next one, Timmy? Do you have any idea?
That's a good question. That's an excellent question. I know. Well, I'd like to, especially after this conversation, I would love to delve into prayer a little bit, because I think that's, an obvious next step.
Yeah.
As far as the drum topic, you wanna hit on linear patterns?
Yeah, let's do linear patterns. So next week we'll do drum topic, linear patterns, and God topic will be prayer.
Awesome. I dig it.
And
dig it.
You'll need all the prayer you can get to get through linear patterns.
Oh my gosh. You guys should probably start praying now. Well, if I don't know if this needs to be said, but definitely check us out on Instagram, Facebook, make sure you follow. If you guys have cool ghost note grooves that you'd like to share, make sure you tag hashtag Holy Ghost Notes.
Right.
And if you have any questions or want us to touch on anything in future episodes, make sure you reach out. Our email is Matt and Tim @theholyghostnotes.com. So
that's right. Thank you, Timmy. Yeah.
Thank you, Matt. We'll see you guys next time.
We'll be seeing you.